But I think the critical thing is to find out what went wrong compared to what you expected, and then use that to try and understand the future. I don't think it's always possible to have a backup plan.
This is Smarter Sourcing, a show dedicated to helping sourcing and procurement leaders elevate their influence and get their seat at the table. Our mission is to empower listeners to reimagine their roles and make that happen. In each episode, we'll speak with an innovative leader to distill best practices, learn from their mistakes, and leave you with actionable insights that you can immediately put to work. Here's your host, executive producer for Smarter Sourcing, John Pavia. Now let's jump right into today's episode.
So welcome everyone to this edition of Smarter Sourcing. My name is John Pavia, and I am here in Boca Raton, Florida at the CAGNY Conference, the Consumer Analyst Group of New York. And I happened to run into my good friend, Ray Silcock, who was a CFO of a bunch of companies. I'm going to let him tell you about his career as a CFO at several different companies, including U.S. Tobacco and Key Storage, which I know there's a parent company name. But it would be a great opportunity to talk to somebody who has been the senior financial executive at a number of companies, both public and private, and his experience with sourcing, procurement, supply chain, and to get his perspective on that. So Ray, thanks so much for joining us today. This is really cool for me to be able to sit down with you.
Good to see you.
So before we get into everything, why don't you give, and I think this could eat up the whole half hour, probably an hour and a half, of your background going from school through your different companies that you were CFO.
Okay. I grew up in the UK, as you can possibly tell.
You're Italian.
I lived here. I joined the Franklin Mint in the UK, and the international division was headquartered there. Franklin Mint was a manufacturer of commemoratives and gold coins and gold medals.
One of those companies that you say, how did this company make, and you told me once before, you'd be surprised that people around the world who want these commemoratives.
Yes, it's a particular trait that some of you have. And I worked for them in the UK for a couple of years, and they decided to move in 1977. They decided to move the international headquarters, which was then in London, to the US. And they asked me if I would go with them, and I agreed. They took about 10 or 12 people. I was fortunate. My boss, who was the VP of finance, didn't want to go, so I had the opportunity to go instead. We moved to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I was fortunate enough to have that opportunity to come to the US, which really completely changed my life, to be honest with you. And the Franklin Mint, however, ran into trouble. It overexpanded. 1976 was the bicentenary of the United States. Obviously, in 1977, I think it was the Diamond Jubilee for the Queen of England, both occasions on which many people bought commemoratives, and someone drew a line on the graph and concluded that Franklin Mint was going to grow forever. And obviously, that did not happen. And the Franklin Mint got into trouble. I enjoyed living in the States. I decided I wanted to stay. I had already had a green card, and I was able to take a job. I looked for a job locally in Philadelphia because I had friends in the area now. And I found a job at Campbell Soup Company, where I worked for the next 18 years. Soon after I joined Campbell Soup, the company acquired a business in Argentina, a meatpacker, and they asked me if I would go down to work in the meatpacker. And the time came 2 or 3 years later when it was time to rotate home. And right around that time, and they had a job picked out in the US to return to. And right around that time, there was a big devaluation of the Argentine peso. The CEO of Campbell Soup Company came down to see what was happening. The company was an important company to Campbell. They provided all of the meat for the different products, from Swanson dinners to meat-based soups. And he approached me and said, would I be willing to stay for an extra 6 months or a year until the situation stabilized? And he said, what would it take for me to do that? So I told him that I wanted to go and do an MBA. And I should explain that I left school when I was 16 and I didn't have an undergraduate degree. But he said, well, I can't get you in. I said, I know. Would you write me a letter of recommendation and would you pay for it? He said, yes, that's the deal. So we came back to the, I eventually, a year later, came back to the US, looked around for a job. And I found a job in a division, the beverage division of Campbell Soup, that was being run by a man who, until about a year or two prior, had been a tenured professor at Wharton. And he made a few phone calls, and a couple of days later, I got a phone call from Wharton saying, come back and talk to us. So they told me that if I scored the 95th percentile on my GMAS, they let me in for my MBA. So I did, and I went and did an MBA at Wharton, which was also something that was very important as being a building block of my career.
At this point, right, even as your career is just really blossoming, starting out with Campbell Soup, Do you think back, especially when you contrast it to coming out of this pandemic and watching and actually being at Perrigo and feeling that impact of worldwide event that really disrupted the supply chain? Back then, what were those things that kept you up at night as you was, as your company, especially the division down in Brazil, was thinking about what can't go wrong here? We need redundancy to make sure that we can be in business in the day to day.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The camel soup had really an extremely long and complicated supply chain for getting the meat from Argentina to Campbell's Soup's plants on the east and west coast of the US. Mostly the meat was brought into the east coast. And the issue was that we had boats, so it took 6 to 8 weeks, depending on various things, but 6 weeks, let's say, to get from Argentina to the east coast of the US. They were refrigerated. The meat was cooked in Argentina. The cattle were slaughtered in Argentina, butchered, and then the meat that was being used, some of the meat was sold in a fresh meat market into the EU, or in those days, it was just Europe. And you know, the pieces that were being used by Campbell were cooked and frozen and then shipped as what we called frozen cooked beef. So that supply chain was long and complicated. That year, talking about global supply chain interruptions, that year, and I don't rightly recall why, but there was the US sanctioned Russia by refusing to let them buy US grain. So as a consequence, the plant that we had in Argentina, which was on the river in a city called Rosario, and the plant, from the top of the plant, was a six-story high plant, you could look down over the river, and there would be a line of ships with hammer and sickle flags on them, waiting to load with grain. We weren't selling the grain, but there was a grain plant next door, or a grain storage facility next door. So it was a constant worry that we would be able to make those ships or to get that whole supply chain had to be handled exactly right. Otherwise, the plants in the US would wind up with insufficient product, or potentially we wouldn't have storage, sufficient storage for the frozen cooked beef, which obviously had required specialized storage. So that was our biggest concern, quite frankly. Well, maybe not our biggest. Our biggest concern was the volatility of the meat prices in Argentina, because meat prices fluctuate from day to day much more than they do in the US. We had buyers in the markets, the Argentine markets called lineas, but it was constant battle between that and the exchange rate and the precariousness of the Argentine economy. Inflation was roaring in lots of places, including the US in 1980s, very early 1980s, especially 80, 81. And in Argentina, the inflation was such that in the restaurants, they didn't have prices on the menu. They printed the menu up with a little blank beside where the price should be. And they would sometimes change the price between lunch and dinner because that's how fast the inflation was going.
So let me ask, because there are so many different areas we can go into, but I want to move forward. So I know you were there, and then from Campbell, so you come back to the US, you go to Wharton, and then you stay at Campbell or you...
Yes. As a matter of fact, I did go back to Campbell after I did my MBA, and I spent another 10 years there, and I rose to become VP Finance for the International Division. And then my final 3-year position at Campbell was VP Finance of the Bakery and Confectionery Division.
And I'm going to push you through a little bit only because they got to condense this down to 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. Here, if you can go into what came after Campbell.
So after Campbell had a very strictly enforced non-solicit policy. So my former boss, who had been the CFO at Campbell, became the head of the Bakery and Confectionery Division and invited me to go work for him, essentially recruited me, if you like, to the VP Finance slot for his division. He left the company and I did not go with him because of this non-solicit policy, which was also combined with a non-compete as well, and both of which were very rigorously enforced by Campbell Soup. So anyway, I left Campbell and went to a small frozen food company on the West Coast in San Diego. I spent that year there as the CFO. It was actually a transformational year. That business was interesting from a supply chain side. The biggest challenge we had was that it's a small company, but it had maybe $100 million in sales, but it had 1,000 women who made the products by hand. And our challenge was obviously to try and reduce that number of women.
What was the food?
It was actually, they were called taquitos, small tacos. that was sold to what in those days was Price Club and Costco. Obviously, they went, got together, but it was all basically all sold to them. And it was frozen, and they had to be essentially in the plant. We made the tortillas, and these what these women did was put the filling into them and roll them up to form kind of what we might call flautas if we spoke Spanish. And they were doing that, and it was just a huge challenge. The people had to cross the border, and that was every day, and go home every night. So it was just a huge challenge in terms of making sure that people got there every day, making sure that we had sufficient staff, and doing our best to try and convert the plant, which we ultimately sold the business to Heinz.
So that's amazing, because you must watch what's going on right now on the border, on the wall of border issues. And this is what, 1980-something?
This was 1997.
Okay, so 1997. But still, you were living it, that experience of your workers are coming over legally every day and then going back over.
They had transponders that allowed them to go through special lanes.
Oh, really?
And they had to sign that basically if they were ever caught doing anything wrong, like smuggling somebody or smuggling goods, that was a go to jail immediately. Sort of, they accepted that they would be heavily penalized. But we never had any problems with that. There were traffic jams at the border that caused us problems. Generally speaking, this particular border crossing.
So this is procuring talent. And what was the backup plan, if anything ever had? Did you have a backup plan? No. As they close the border?
If they closed the border, we didn't have a backup plan.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a brand new plant. We built it on a piece of land that was set between Tijuana and San Diego. For many years, the people were stopped from building on the land by the respective city governments who wanted to put a... If you've ever been to San Diego Airport, it's a very crowded, congested airport. You fly right past residential and office buildings. You can see in the windows as you're coming to land. It's quite unique for them in that respect. And the idea was to have one airport for Tijuana and San Diego, put it on this piece of land, and then you'd have the planes would all land on the same runways, and one would go to the Mexico side and one would go to the US. Great idea. Politically, it never got into traction.
For another time, I got stranded. I missed my flight in San Diego one year.
And I drove out to Tijuana.
Well, I was supposed to go to meeting friends in Cabo. And no more flights out of the U.S. You had to be there 2 hours ahead of time. And the guy gave me an idea, get into an Uber, go to the border. And today they have this facility that you can check in on the U.S. side
right.
And walk up on a bridge that goes over the highway and come down and walk right into Tijuana Airport on the Mexico side. And I took a local airline to Cabo. All right. So now that company gets bought by Kraft Heinz.
We was long before Kraft.
Oh, right. It was just Kraft.
We said sorry to Heinz, but I left just before it was actually finalized. And because my former boss from Campbell called me up and said, I'd been asked to take a position as CEO of a company called Cott. And it was a private label soft drink manufacturer based in Toronto, Canada. Most of the business was in the U.S.
In Tampa, was Cott in Tampa?
Cott was in Tampa, yeah. Half a dozen plants in the U.S. at the time I joined. Then they had a business in Canada, and they also had a decent sized business in the U.K. And they had a random bunch of businesses. It was run by a true entrepreneur. It was $1 billion in revenue annually and made no money. He was trying to become the General Foods of private label. And he used to really aggravate the big branded companies, especially Coke and Pepsi, by talking about brand tax. That was his. He would give presentations where he talked about the brand tax, which he defined as being the premium that you pay for buying a branded product when you could buy a non-branded product. So without getting into the semantics of that whole argument, the company had done a fantastic job in building it. He had really. His name was Jerry Pinser, and he was infamous as being the Keating of Canada. If you remember who Keating was and the
G5 and
Charles Keating and
the scandal with the senators, the whole thing.
Yeah.
And Glenn, yeah.
Yeah. And also, I don't know if it's that one or not. This Keating. Remember the mortgage crisis?
That was him.
It was him. Okay.
And yeah, a bunch of U.S. senators
Yeah. So anyway, this guy was supposed to be the Keating of Canada. They call them trust companies in Canada, but they're like savings and loan companies here. And they're exactly the same. And he got fired. And he came back to Toronto, and he didn't have anything to do. And his father said, you can run Cott. At the time, it was a Montreal-based manufacturer of Cott-branded goods. And he decided to go for private label. And he had gone to school with the son of the CEO of Loblaws. Loblaws is the largest supermarket chain in Canada. And his roommate at school was the CEO, I believe, owner or founder of Loblaws. It was his father. So anyway, this man said to him, all right, he said, well, I'll put you in the store if you can get me a product that tastes, that can beat Coke and Pepsi in taste tests, and is the dollar a case or more cheaper. So a famous soft drink company that called Royal Crown had recently been acquired by Vic Posner, an infamous Wall Street raider from the 70s and 80s, maybe even the 90s. And he went and saw Vic. Now, this man, Jerry Pencer, and I don't know anything about Vic Posner at all, but Jerry Pencer, they said that if you met him for half an hour, he was your friend for life. And if you met him for an hour, he was your best friend for life. And he had this magic, and he was not a physically attractive man. I've seen pictures of him.
At least alive.
No.
That's good. I won't see this.
No. He just wasn't particularly attractive, but he was very, very persuasive. And he persuaded Vic Posner into this deal where he would have an exclusive, he would exclusively buy private label concentrates from Royal Crown, including cola. And none of the flavor houses at this point, which was somewhere in the middle, late 90s, no one had figured out how to make cola. Cola was made by a multi-step progress, a two-step progress, really, where some of the ingredients were added right at the end. This was all carefully guarded by both Coke, Pepsi, or all three companies, Coke, Pepsi, and Royal Crown, just carefully shielded. Today, the flavor houses have cracked the code, by the way, but in those days, they hadn't. So you, and cola is like 55%, as the flavor profile is 55% of all soft drinks in the US. If you didn't have a good cola, then you didn't have a good brand. So anyway, this lesser form contract wasn't reviewed by lawyers before being signed. I come back to that point. So he built the business over the next period of time. I guess it was from the mid-90s. I think maybe even early 90s when I think about it, because I think for the Resolution Trust Company or Crisis was in the early 90s. And he was able to build this company such a large size that the COT became somewhere in the order of 75% user of all the concentrates being made by Royal Crown, mainly cola, because cola is a big one anyway, but other concentrates too, other flavors. Then he died. He, first of all, Jerry Pencer had brain cancer, and although he thought he'd recovered and he infamously appeared on stage as Superman saying he'd beaten his cancer, he succumbed to the disease, sadly. I never met him in person because, and that's when Frank Wise, the CEO, the man who I'd worked for at Campbell Soup Company, he took the job and he called me and said, would I come with him? And I said, well, can I live in Philadelphia? He said, well, I plan to. So I said, yes. And we lived in Philadelphia and we commuted. This is pre-9/11. It was a bit different after 9/11, but pre-9/11, I could leave my apartment in downtown Philadelphia at 5:30, be on a 6 a.m. flight and be in my office in Toronto at 8:15. Let's say that became much more challenging after 9/11 and the security check-ins and so forth.
And then COT became huge with the COT water, didn't it?
Well, that's after me. So I was there until from 1998 until 2005.
Okay.
And quite frankly, we resisted water because water wasn't profitable. Nestle made branded water and they could put their water, they had five plants in what they called the Smile around in the United States. They said, starting off in the Northeast and going around into the West Coast. And they could put water into stores cheaper than we could put it on the floor of our plants.
I see.
Because they were just had these massive plants and they took in the granules for making the plastic components and they turned them into the bottles and the caps. And then they filled them with water from their spring that was underground up at the plant or nearby. It was just a fantastic, smooth operation.
So I want to go back to then to the cola part, right? Because you guys are, you're in competition with Coke and Pepsi. They probably hate you guys, right? At the time.
Yes.
Right? So in a situation like that, how are they trying to impact your business? Or did they try to impact it negatively with dropping up prices of some of your core components that go into your product? Or what are the things that?
I don't think they ever did that. I never observed them taking any action like that. But they definitely, we sold 2 liters, where at that time, the 2 liter was the big container. And at that time, we had 2 liter, I think at 79 cents. And if they dropped their price on promotion, and they were more like, you know, around the dollar, 99 cents. And if they dropped their price like into the low 80s, like 81, 82, 83 cents, they could definitely take a bite of our sales.
But could they move the market? Like, I don't know all the things that go into making a soft drink, right? But could they move the market on one of your other components? Like, I have someone who I know at Starbucks. And the thing that drives people crazy, and the guys who run Starbucks around the world, is getting the base for Frappuccino, and the price fluctuates like crazy. It's hard to get.
Yeah.
Was there any component part of the soft drinks that the market would fluctuate and you go driving guys crazy?
I never observed that, because basically colas or soft drinks in general are very simple products. They're water and concentrate and a sweetener. Mm. So the dirty secret of soft drinks is that soft drinks are cheaper than sugared ones, at least in the US, because the sugar price of sugar is kept artificially high in the US, and the price of sweeteners is not. It's relatively lower. So diet drinks are much more profitable for soda companies than full sugar ones.
So let me ask you this question. So how long are you at Cotton now? How long does that go on before you make your next leap?
Yes, 7 years.
Okay, and what's the next place you go? Is that where you go to US Tobacco?
No, that's where I went to Swift. The company called Swift, which is the company I worked for in Argentina.
Yeah.
It was called Swift Armor originally, and it was broken up in the early part of the 20th century by the FTC. And because that was one of the biggest industry in the US at that time, was cattle slaughtering. So they broke it up, and the international business fragmented country by country. And I worked for the one in Argentina. There was one in Brazil. There was one in Uruguay, as I recall. And in the US, it was broken into Swift and Armor. And back in the 20, I don't know exactly, but in the early 2000s, someone put it back together again, the Swift in the US. And it was owned by a private equity company. And that's who I went to work for after leaving COT.
So up to this point, was there a moment where you all of a sudden said to yourself, man, this procurement, I need to be focused on this because this really impacts me. I mean, maybe it was from day one. Or was there a moment where in your progression, your own evolution, you were like, boy, I'm the top finance guy, or one of the, even earlier on, the senior finance guys, and you decided, all right, I really need to play a bigger role in this process and know exactly what we're buying and who's, and make sure my talent's really great, because what we buy things at and is very important to what we sell it for and how much profit we make.
So I think it's always been top of mind. Even when I worked at the Franklin Mint, around the time I came to the States, and a very infamous thing that occurred was that the Hunt brothers tried to corner the world market for silver. But the Franklin Mint sold a lot of gold. Generally speaking, it wasn't solid gold. It was what they called vermeil, which is gold-plated silver. See, so they can still say it's precious metal through and through, because silver's a precious metal too, but obviously a fraction of the cost of gold. And the Hunt brothers managed to bid up the price of silver, rather, to heights that I think have never been seen since. And then it all collapsed because the corners are very hard, and there happens to be a great deal of silver in the world. And they were unsuccessful, and I believe lost quite a lot of their fortune as a consequence of that effort. But that really affected the profitability of the Franklin Mint when I was there. And I was first had involved the understanding that I wasn't involved necessarily in fixing the problem, if there was a fix, but I was involved in analyzing the impact of the rising price and understood what it was doing to the Franklin Mint's margins. Franklin Mint was a public company.
Sure. So back to Swift.
I go back to Swift. I got hired by the CEO and by the private equity firm that owned it.
What was the CEO firm, you remember?
Hicks Mews.
Okay.
This is 2006, I believe. Yes, it was. It was 2006 because that's the year I got married, and my wife taken a job, and she, Morgan Stanley, she was in New York, and she had to give the job up because we moved to Denver, because that was headquartered just outside Denver. So we lived in Denver. I'll tell you the story. I'm sure you want to include it necessarily, but you warned me when John was interviewing, under observation by the
SEC.
No, by ICE. And so inside meatpacking plants is basically a completely Spanish environment, right? Spanish language environment. And because nearly all of the people, where she played reasonably well, you could, I don't know the average for all workers, but if you worked on the disassembly line, if you worked on the butchering line, it's a very unyielding product. And I knew a little about it from my years in Argentina, which is why they wanted to hire me, rightly. But on the line, on the actual, where the cattle are butchered, it's very hard work. And, but you could still make 40, at that time, you could make $40,000 a year. And this was in the early 2000s. And that was a decent living wage, especially because the meatpacking plants were generally in remote country areas where the cost of living was relatively low. And so I think it was a good job for those people.
So how long did this stint go at Swift? that you were with them for this?
Oh, I was there for about 18 months, but we sold it. Uh-huh. So what happened was they told me they were under suspicion, and I told the board, we have to fight this. I mean, we can't just lay down and let the federal government come roll over. They were said, you can come into a couple of your plants and we'll take people out that are illegal. And then when we pushed back against this, it actually wound up in federal court, and the judge eventually ruled against us and said, no, it's a police action, so the federal government doesn't have control over police action. That's a state issue. I don't recall exactly what the reasons were, but there was a judge that it was a police action and they couldn't do anything about it. So what they did was very clever. They claimed there was criminality involved. So in other words, not like we were hiring criminals. Finally, when we got into court, the company said, well, what's the criminality? Because they wouldn't tell us what the crimes were. And the crime was people were using fake social security numbers, which obviously is a crime. But we said, well, you point out the people that were using fake socials, we'll let you arrest them and take them away. Most of them, we used, I forget what it's called now, they have a system, which is the name of which is escaped me, but we used that system, their system, for checking to see if people had their proper social security number. But the trouble is, you could have more than one job, and lots of these people did have more than one job. And lots of people generally, by the way, have more than one job, right? And so their social security number being used doesn't tell you it's not available for use, if that makes sense. Yep. Because you could just, people would have other jobs with it. So anyway, one day they came in and raided our plants, and they took out from one of our plants, especially the one actually close to our corporate headquarters, just outside Denver, it was a plant in Greeley, Colorado. And they took out so many workers that we had to shut a shift down. And the plants are a big capital asset, obviously. The work is, whilst not fully skilled, is a semi-skilled role. You can't take someone off the street. Someone's got to have some experience. It's not, as I say, it's not classified as skilled to cut the meat up. Maybe it should be, but it's semi-skilled. It takes time to learn. And when they took all these people out, we lost the ability to run the plant for two shifts a day. And that seriously impacts the profitability of a meatpacking plant when it can only be run for one shift.
Mm.
Because you've got this big capital asset sitting there that you've got to maintain. So we decided, instead of what we were trying to do, which is turn the company around, it was a big company. We had plants in Australia as well as in the US, and we had about 20,000 employees. It was a pretty decent sized company.
That's a good company.
Yeah. And we sold it eventually. And it was when we sold it that I moved to U.S. Tobacco.
I think if someone said to me, okay, so here's resume and here's his different jobs that he had and here are the different companies from a procurement standpoint, and I'm saying procurement in all the different things you need to be focused on, because there you have the core product and then you have lots of distribution, packaging, marketing, the whole thing. I would think that might have been the most complicated and hard to understand, but complicated in terms of global supply chain, global distribution,
very
et cetera. Would that be a good guess?
Yes, very much so. That was the meatpacking industry in and of itself is the closest thing I think that comes to the meatpacking industry is oil, where you sell oil by cracking it into different fragments, right? Into different products.
Oil, oil,
heating oil, your diesel, bunker for eight of them, and et cetera. But cattle is the same. I mean, there's no real reason why a filet mignon, it costs more than the same weight of, say, the cow's tail, except that people will pay more for the filet mignon than they'll pay for the tail.
Right.
And interestingly, in Argentina, and this was developed when the British basically ran Argentina, even though they never actually owned it, but they never actually ruled it, rather they owned it for the most part. And these meatpacking plants were all developed by the British, and they came up with a product called canned corned beef, which you can buy in an American supermarket today. It's much more popular in England than it is here. And it's made from bits and pieces that are left over.
I was never a corned beef fan.
You can't corn beef.
Not especially canned corned beef. No, I'll never eat it.
This is the leftover pieces, and it's cooked in that distinctively shaped can that they do, which you see you can still find on probably, well, not probably, it's definitely sold at Publix up the road.
Yeah.
And not far from walking distance from this hotel. So that was designed to use the last pieces of meat. The best pieces of meat are the prime cuts, the filet mignons and the ribs and so forth. So all of those primal cuts, and then you get the pieces that go into the cooked beef, and then you get the bits left over, which we wouldn't accept into cooked beef if we were Campbell's Soup, for example. and they sold that. And the price that you get for each piece comes together to form the value that you could pay for the cow. So we found out that what Swift Arno had been doing in Argentina, they had this they called it triangulation, and they set up a company in Uruguay that would buy the canned corn beef, and they could manipulate from Swift Arno, and they could, by changing the price they would pay, they could actually manipulate the profitability of the Argentine Swift Arno company.
Wow.
So it's not as easy here. We have a different mix of products that come out of the American plant.
So in that industry, it really was the essence of the product at the beginning was less expensive than the sum of its parts.
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, that's right. You took the animal apart in order to get value.
Yeah.
So, and the animal, but also the price you pay for the animal fluctuated tremendously. I mean, we had teams of economists at Swift Arno. We didn't have this in Argentina because Argentina is just more of a cowboy environment. Because between the exchange rate and the price of the cattle and export taxes, believe it or not, they tax the exports. Between all of those, it made Argentina much more volatile. But here in the U.S., in the U.S. company, which ended up ultimately being owned, by the way, but they put it back together again, a company called JBS, a Brazilian company, bought the Swift Arno. We sold it to them. I sold it to them. The brothers who owned it, the Batista brothers, they did not speak very good English when they were, they do now, I believe, because they've become much more.
Because you burnt them on that deal.
No, no, no.
We got to improve our English. All right, so let's get to U.S. tobacco. How do you make the leap to U.S. tobacco? What year was that?
That was 2007. And so I went to Swift Arno in early 2006, and then to 2007, I went to UST.
They still in Greenwich back then?
They were. I bought a house in Greenwich that I could actually see the office from.
Oh, wow. But that's still a hot year. I mean, there's a lot going on in 2007 as it relates to taxing tobacco. And I know you guys were Skoll, Copenhagen, right? So it's the snuff and the chew. But still, there's a lot of political, there's a lot of politics around tobacco at the time. There is today. But back then, I think it was probably even hotter in terms of the pressure on you guys.
Yeah, I would say. Although, I mean, what essentially was happened that year was the FDA was given the authority to regulate tobacco products. And although they hadn't really exercised that authority, ultimately they did, obviously. Into like starting in really 2008, and the culmination was obviously being able to regulate Juul and stuff like that.
Yeah. So when you've come into that role, what is your organization like? So you got your finance guys on your sourcing and procurement and everything to do with your supply chain. Are those guys reporting ultimately in CFO? And what kind of organization are you?
No, they had their own separate organization. It's a very specialized supply chain because it's an agricultural product. It's a plant. And also because it takes a very long time to make. So tobacco would be grown, and then the tobacco was smoked in barns, which is totally an unbelievable sight to see. The barns have an open floor, and they put a fire. They burn firewood down at the bottom of the barn where the tobacco is being hung from hooks on rafters.
So that's how you make whiskey and bourbon, where you burn Johnny Walker wool. Bring in wood like crazy, and they burn it, and then they put in these big vats in the tent.
Yeah, it's slightly different then, because you actually burn the inside of the barrel to make scotch, right? Bourbon. Here, imagine a large barn with hooks on all the rafters, and on each hook you hang a bundle of tobacco leaves, which are very large, and they're very big. And then on the floor, underneath them, you put the material that you burn, and you burn it, and it smokes for several days.
And what, the tobacco that's hanging sort of absorbs?
Right. Okay. It gets smoked.
Right.
And then it winds up in being chopped up and then put into hogsheads. Hogsheads are very large barrels.
Wow.
And it's stored for several years until it's used, depending on the product it's got. Especially Copenhagen, I think it takes four years to make a tobacco for Copenhagen.
Okay, so that's your direct side, direct cost. But on everything else that comes, and there's a lot going on with even to this day. So you've got your... You've got a whole marketing department. You've got all your other costs that wouldn't be considered indirect. And now, at the time, how was that set up in terms of centralized, decentralized, and reporting to you?
No, that didn't report to the CFO. That reported directly up to a different channel. But bear in mind that at U.S. Tobacco, we had two major product streams, and they were run by presidents. One was called U.S. Smokeless Tobacco Company, and that made Skoll, Copenhagen, and the other products. Basic is Gold in Copenhagen with the two marquee brands. And then there were some other brands underneath, sub-brands underneath that. The sign was Y. And US Tobacco owned, they were bought it, it built it over many years, the St. Michel Mine Estates. And I think we produced between a quarter and a third of all the wine made in the US state of Washington. And we had big vineyards up there. We had plants just outside Seattle. So it was a huge operation, quite successful, a lot of very good wines, but it was never profitable in the way that tobacco is. So we made, you know, there's the old joke in the wine industry about how do you make a small fortune in the wine industry? You start with a big fortune. We made money and we built it on the company. I wasn't involved in it at all, but the company had built it from scratch. When I got there, we were starting to expand out of just being in Washington State, buying wineries like Erath in Oregon and Stag's Leap in California. So the company...
So you got wine and tobacco, each of those...
Businesses. They had their own separate
issues, yes. Right?
And they had their own separate issues.
But they're then reporting ultimately into the mothership, which is your company, and you're the CFO there.
Yes, okay. That's correct.
So you're looking at the bottom line, but you're looking at all your costs, right? And then you're leaning on your CFOs of those businesses?
Correct.
Got it.
We have separate CFOs in each of those businesses.
Yeah.
And though the smokeless tobacco, the U.S. Smokeless Tobacco Company, was co-located with the corporate offices in Greenwich. And then ultimately we moved out to Stamford.
So when you have an organization that big, and we're at this conference here in Florida right now, and these are all the huge food companies, right? And you got Sysco and General Mills. And I understand you've got your division presidents of the businesses and they each have a CFO and they've got a procurement organization. When you're a CFO of that large a company, because even back then, how many billions was in top line revenue was UST?
About 2 billion.
Okay, so then how are you playing your traffic controller? And then when your CFO comes in or your division president comes in and a quarter they underperform, and I know the UST, I don't know how many they ever underperformed, but how much into the weeds will you go in understanding what causes your products, whether on the wine side or on the tobacco side, to be, you know, miss their forecast penny by a dollar, whatever? How far into the weeds do you get into the cost base of these products?
Well, I think it's fair to say that depends. If it was a big miss, truly needed to be able to explain it to the wider world, then as deep as necessary. So trying to understand whether something, and if it was something particular, and this isn't anything to do with UST, but during the pandemic, we had huge freight cost overruns bringing in products that we made in China. I mean, it had to be dug into and understood, not only from the point of view of explaining why we missed, but also from the point of view of explaining what would happen on a forward looking, which actually is much more interesting.
And that's a Perrigo, right? Or a Perrigo. All right. So Perrigo, pharmaceutical drug manufacturer.
Soon after I got to Perrigo, we bought an oral care company that made electric toothbrushes in particular, and that came out of China. Quite a lot of their products came out of China and were heavily impacted by the pandemic shipping cost issues.
What was the reaction to that? I was like, you're getting hit with these increased costs for shipping that now, like you said before, it depends. And this is one where you're like, all right, I got to dive deep into this one. What was the, okay, here's the plan. Here's how we're going to either mitigate or correct this.
Well, when you say, what was the reaction from the outside world?
No, you, from CFO.
Then I would sit down probably with the CFO of the individual business and say, okay, explain to me, give me some examples I can use. The shipping cost of X is gone to Y, and what does that mean? Is that, can you tell me how much it costs to ship a container? Can you tell me how much it costs to ship it? I remember some of the numbers. I mean, they were extreme numbers. Like the cost of shipping a container at one point went from like $6,000 in 2019 to like $26,000 in the middle of the pandemic a year later. So those, I mean, those numbers are isolated examples. But yes, the kind of, you know, the understanding the real guts of that was critical to being able to explain it. And being able to explain it was critical to being able to ameliorate the impact that the bad news had on the street and the company's stock price. And also being able to say, well, it might be 26,000 now, but we can already see, as it was in the last quarter that I'm explaining to you, but it's already changing. It's going, hopefully, it's going down. It was going down. But it was a real peak, if you recall, in that sort of...
Yeah, rebuilt this. Yeah, I know it was action in that world.
It didn't come down right away.
No.
But it isn't completely down
now. No. So right now at this conference, I was just talking about with the CFO of one of the largest food companies in the world, and we're just downstairs having a cup of coffee. And so pretend for a second that you're with a bunch of these CFOs with these companies that have distribution all over the world. Not only that, they have their supply chains are from all over the world with all the products that they make. And you're sitting out with them and they said, so, you know, what's your advice on staying ahead of these issues, or at least not trying to mitigate those amount of times where something happens in some far off place of the world, the Red Sea, China, wherever, and we have to, it's going to impact us on our products from the guy who's in the chair, the big chair from the CFO standpoint. What's your advice on how do you stay ahead of those things? What's this one guy tell me the first thing he does in the morning? He goes to the Wall Street Journal. He wants to know what's going on around the world. He was the chief procurement officer of a very large company. And he said he wakes up and he's with a company that if there's something that's blown up on the other side of the planet, it could very well impact the price of their product. So he's really always having building contingency plans for that. What would your advice be to those kind of CFOs or those kinds of companies?
Well, first of all, I think finding out what's going on is the key, right? So the way you do that is starting off by understanding what happened. So first of all, the shipping costs went up. How much? What was the impact of that particular thing? What else went up, and were there things that offset it? Did something else happen that would offset some of that cost? The real key to being able to predict what's going to happen, which is after all what we're really trying to do, is to figure out what's going to happen in the future so that we can take steps to avoid it by buying it from somewhere else, shipping it by a different way.
So you talk about redundancy and always having a backup plan?
Well, I don't think it's always possible to always have a backup plan. Let me come back to that in a minute. But I think the critical thing is to find out what went wrong compared to what you expected, and then use that to try and understand the future. I don't think it's always possible to have a backup plan. I mean, at Perrigo, for example, we had joint venture in China making some pharmaceutical ingredients when we owned those joint ventures. They represented investments that we had made, and finding a way around, especially we were contractually obligated to buy some of the stuff. Perhaps it's not easy just to say, okay, we're going to have a separate source. You can develop one over time, but there again, it comes down to analyzing what has happened so that you can understand what caused whatever the impact was. And that's the case where you develop an alternative plan or a plan B if you want to get around it. I don't think you can start off, that's my experience, it's very hard to start off with an assumption that something is going to go wrong, because of course there are tons of things that can go wrong. But having a plan continuously for things going wrong, to me, is really, first of all, it can be something that you cause to happen if you're not careful.
Yeah. So these conferences, like when you told me that you'd come to the CAGNY conference and to other conferences.
Yes.
It was funny. I was down listening to another company present, and I happened to walk out before it was completely done. And I ran into the CFO of this company's major competitor. And I'm not going to say who it was, but these are huge companies.
Right.
And I said, so you come listen, you go to the other breakout sessions. And he goes, I always like to know what the other guys are doing. Then we got to talk a little bit. He said, but I actually enjoy spending time with my counterpart over at the other company. At these conferences, were they good for you? Did you learn stuff from them? Because the CFOs were getting hammered by the analyst. But did you also use them as a chance to, you're getting out of your office, which can become very insular, some of these big companies. Did you enjoy coming to these conferences? Did you learn stuff also? Or was it just one of those things where you knew you were going to get 1,000 questions from 100 different analysts?
I think that certainly, how are you going to get 1,000 questions from 100 different analysts? That's for sure. So being prepared by understanding what's happened and being able to explain the consequences, positive and negative, of the various changes is crucial. You have to understand it. I would definitely go and listen to other people's presentations from competing companies. I'd never developed a relationship with anybody at a competing company, to be honest with you. I can't think of that happening. I mean, we knew the players, and sometimes you knew them and sometimes you didn't, from presentations and panels and things. I don't think I ever got to the point where I would have a more one-on-one kind of a relationship with someone like that.
What was your, out of all the different jobs you had, and you had a lot of really interesting ones, which one do you go back to and say, that was the most formative for me, not just finance standpoint, but again, this podcast is focused on sourcing, procurement, supply chain. Which was the one that you think you evolved the most in really understanding how to manage down the weeds, but manage from sort of that air traffic controller CFO role? Those folks who are really impacting the bottom line by either really being shuffled what they do in terms of buying at the right price, making sure to the extent that you should have redundancy. What job do you think you really evolved the most because it really challenged you in that regard?
Well, I think I'd have to say the Swift Armor job in Argentina, because it was just, there were so many moving pieces.
Before they put the pieces of the car.
Yeah. But I mean, there were so many moving pieces from an economic point of view. The currency was unpredictable or difficult to predict. The economy itself, the government's responses by putting taxes on or refusing to convert money. They had separate exchange rates. There was an exchange rate you paid on the street to the people who would change money in the black market, which was well known, published in the newspapers, and was the sort of quote-unquote real exchange rate. And then there was the rate that the government, the Central Bank of Argentina, would exchange at, which was very different, multiples of, it were huge differences at times. So this, that caused the price of cattle to move, government policies changed all the time. And, you know, I think that combined with the relative, especially when I was young, when I was in Argentina, I was in my early 30s, late 20s and early 30s during my tenure there. And it was hugely both challenging, but it also a time when I think you learn and absorb more because you haven't seen as much in your career up to that point. So I think, and quite frankly, just living in Argentina is almost like an economic awakening or education, because it is such a dynamic economy. That, not using the word dynamic to mean that it moves around all the time, not implying that it's a great economy. It's obviously a miserable economy for the people who live there.
When you left Puerto Rico, AI had not yet really impacted your business yet.
No, it really hadn't.
No. What do you see now? I mean, because I'm downstairs at a lot of these sessions. It's amazing to hear. They're all trying to figure out. They're all using AI. They're all trying to figure out how best to use AI, how to get a competitive advantage. It is fascinating that here, this common theme amongst very large companies who are in the CPG, consumer staples space, them really still figuring out their strategy and how they're using AI.
I think it has the potential to completely change the way that American business works in certain areas, especially in finance and accounting, where jobs like, you know, looking at invoices, looking at the individual accounting of a company, a lot of that is basic. There's lots of people who are doing clerical tasks inside an accounting department whose jobs, I suspect, could be significantly improved by using AI. And obviously, you know, ultimately, headcount reductions result from that. I don't find that scary. I mean, I think that advances of this type happen every so many generations, and it's not going to result in people not having any work to do, in my opinion. It's going to result in people having better work to do. The people who made fabric by shuffling by hand thought their lives were going to come to an end in the 17th century when the mechanized looms were invented, and the Luddites tried to destroy the mechanized looms.
Yeah.
This is a historical fact. And yet today, there's more people than ever work in the industry of making fabric, but they're not doing the backbreaking work that they were doing 300 years ago, 400 years ago.
Will you ever get to a point where you'll let a car drive itself, or do you? Because I won't. There's no way I'm just going to let a car drive me. I got to put my hands on the wheel.
I already have an autonomous car.
Do you really?
My wife won't let me drive it.
Wow. That's great. That's
no,
awesome.
I mean, seriously, my wife loves to drive, and she doesn't like being driven. So it doesn't bother me. It scares the heck out of her.
Yeah.
But I think that...
And will you go from home to wherever? How long will you go and just let it drive you?
No.
I left that point yet.
No.
Okay.
I was joking. He's autonomous because of my wife.
Oh, I got it. Got it.
Do I believe the autonomous driving will come?
Oh, sure.
I don't know, actually, to be sure. Because
They haven't perfected it.
I think it's a long way.
It is, but I think it'll start with those who really need it and people who have it.
But I think AI, which obviously is related to autonomous driving in some respects, I think AI, there'll be other areas in which AI is much more productive than in autonomous driving. And I think that autonomous driving requires a level of AI which I'm not clear we're going to get to. I mean, in San Francisco, where I used to live 7 years until I moved here to Florida, there's lots of cars being driven around San Francisco with autonomously testing.
Right.
They've had accidents with them, and I think that some of them may have been banned, if not all of them. But the reality is they can never see in the rain, let alone the snow, unless we can evolve very different kinds of sensors from what they've done so far. It's very difficult for humans to see. You're driving up I-95 from here to West Palm, and it comes down with one of those rainstorms. People pull off the road sometimes, and people drive sometimes or slow down. It's very hard to see. I question whether we're ever going to get to the point where cars will drive completely autonomously in all weathers.
Yeah, I think you're right. Although, I got to believe 200 years from now they will be, but not, I don't think, in our lifetime. Where do you think we'll first really see a wider application for AI when it comes to autonomous vehicles just a second ago and how it will affect supply chain?
Well, I think that although the direct effects of AI are going to be felt in clerical work and other things, I think the biggest potential for AI is in autonomous driving. And I think that autonomous driving will come first, true autonomous driving will most likely come first to trucks, where, first of all, trucks are fairly new. You know, the average age of a car in the US is around 12 years, I believe. But trucks, generally speaking, especially the trucks that travel on highways.
We're talking about big 18-wheelers.
Big 18-wheelers taking, quite frankly, the integral parts of the supply chain for most large companies, take, whether it be food companies or companies making other non-consumer goods. Trucks are an integral part of the supply chain. And if we could figure out, for example, a way to have maybe a segregated lane and the driver could go to sleep while the truck was being driven across the US, as opposed to having to park and put the truck out of use for 8 hours while the driver catches up on his legally mandated sleep or rest period, if the truck could be driven autonomously and you could put sensors in the highway or you could have satellites looking down at the highways, geolocation. And this is a huge shortage of truck drivers. They're talking about, if they haven't already done it, licensing 18-year-olds to drive 18-wheelers, which is just so scary in terms of road safety. And so I think that this is a major opportunity to be able to reduce supply chain costs. Transportation costs are a significant part of supply chain costs. Reduce supply chain costs, make the roads safer. You know, I'm sure you have to see harrowing pictures of FedEx and other companies' trucks crashing into the vehicles. I mean, this is a, I don't have statistics in my head at all, but I'm sure that making the roads safer by making trucks safer would be a huge step forward and a very logical way, because there aren't enough truck drivers, you would not be displacing people from work and you would be reducing costs for the consumers across the country.
All right. So listen, we could go on for another 2 hours here, 3 hours. We're going to go and get a break. It's been great visiting with you. I'm so glad the conference was here because I know you're right down the road. Thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. I hope you had a fun time. For all you who tuned in, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Smarter Sourcing. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Smarter Sourcing. For more episodes, visit www.smartersourcing.com or search Smarter Sourcing on your podcast platform of choice.